Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Treatment Update on Mantle Cell Lymphoma. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, including the Lymphoma Research Foundation, who've been a very important partner with us on all of these programs that we do on lymphoma. Now, we have on the call today, because of all of your interest in the call and also the topic, and all of our collaborating organizations, we have over 584 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the United Kingdom. So it really is a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program was sponsored by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Leo Gordon. Dr. Gordon is the Abby and John Friend Professor of Cancer Research. He is Professor in Medicine, Director of Lymphoma Program. He is Co-Director, Hematologic Malignancies Program, Division of Hematology Oncology, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center of Northwestern University, and he's medical director of the John and William Matthews Center for Cellular Therapy. So you can see that actually Dr. Gordon wears many hats, and he is going to begin today by addressing an overview of mantle cell lymphoma, and he's also going to address treatment options for newly diagnosed. So I'm going to now turn this program over to Dr. Gordon.
Thank you, Caroline. It's a pleasure to be on the call. So what I'll try to do, if I can, is to try and see where go over where mantle cell lymphoma fits in the sort of the pantheon of the lymphomas, and talk a little bit about the history, how it developed, how we began to understand it a little bit more, and how that influenced and triggered treatment decisions and options. So, just as a reminder, there are about 80,000 cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in the United States every year. Most of them, about 85% of those, are what we call B-cell lymphomas, and there are probably at least 30 or 40 different kinds of B-cell lymphomas. We tend to think of them, in order to get our heads around this, in two major types, to sort of coalesce those 30 or 40 into two major types, aggressive lymphomas and non-aggressive lymphomas. And you'll see in a moment that mantle cell is a little hard to place. It's a little bit like a pendulum. It's sort of shifted from initially one of the non-aggressive lymphomas, and then when we started to approach it like non-aggressive lymphomas, we recognized that patients had a little bit more aggressive course than we thought, and then began thinking of it more like an aggressive lymphoma. So you'll hear, if you look at the internet and you early literature on this, that because it didn't fit in very well into the non-aggressive lymphomas when it was treated aggressively, it responded, but it didn't respond for as long a duration as the other aggressive lymphomas. Many people thought of it as one of the worst lymphomas to get. That's really no longer the case as we've learned more and more about it and learned how to approach it. The first designation of mantle cell lymphoma came in 1994 when it was recognized as a discrete entity among the B-cell lymphomas. And one of the other very important events was the recognition that there was a very specific chromosome abnormality, a very specific biologic abnormality that really was necessary in order to make the diagnosis of mantle cell lymphoma, and that was a exchange of genetic material between chromosome number 11 and chromosome number 14. And when we talk about genetic material, I want to stress that we don't view this as a heritable disease. These are acquired genetic abnormalities, so we don't think of it as a heritable disease. So initially, people were treated in a very sort of non-aggressive way, and then people began using treatments like CHOP chemotherapy, and a regimen was developed actually at a Children's Hospital here in Chicago, and then at MD Anderson, HyperCVAD was used to treat patients. And what was observed was that the responses were good, but maybe didn't last as long as you might expect. And so in the mid-90s, several things happened. First, there were trials that began using stem cell transplant or bone marrow transplant when people achieved remission. We knew from other lymphomas that in people who maybe relapsed after initial treatment that stem cell transplant could be curative. People began saying, well, maybe if we do a stem cell transplant in remission, we can prolong those remissions and get cures in mantle cell lymphoma. So that happened, but also simultaneously, two other things happened. One, people began using the drug Rituxan. Rituxan was approved for use in really in the mid-90s, 1996, 97, and it began entering into clinical trials in mantle cell lymphoma at about that time and a little bit thereafter. So that happened, and also at the same time, people began noticing that when patients received the drug cytarabine, or ARA-C, one of the drugs that's used in some lymphomas, it's used a lot in leukemias, the responses were better. So those three things, the recognition that Rituxan had a beneficial effect in mantle cell like it does in all of the other B-cell lymphomas, and the drug ARA-C was an important part of the treatment, that really changed our thinking and improved the results in mantle cell lymphoma. You have to remember that mantle cell lymphoma is a disease that tends to occur in people a little bit on the older side. The median age is in the 60s, and it maybe only represents anywhere from maybe 6 to 10% of all of the B-cell lymphoma. So it's not a common type of lymphoma, so it is harder to do large clinical trials with this in order to figure out what the best treatment is. One of the things I want to stress is that when we see a disease that has a lot of different options for treatment and where we've gone from maybe very non-aggressive to a more aggressive treatment, we begin to think of this perhaps that this isn't one disease. And that's one of the messages I want to get over in the next 5 minutes, that we're beginning to understand that there's a lot of information that we're getting that suggests that there may be many diseases that we call mantle cell lymphoma, and that we can make distinctions among patients by both clinical features, that is the extent of the disease, whether people have symptoms or not, but also biologic and molecular features, things that we learn from the biopsy specimen that begin to tell us that maybe there's different types of mantle cell lymphoma. So I think that with that history, it became fairly standard based on a lot of both European and some United States trials that when people had a transplant after initial chemotherapy, they appeared to do better. There were also studies in people who were a little bit older that maybe were not good candidates for stem cell transplant that suggested that if maintenance treatment after initial chemotherapy was done, maintenance treatment with the drug Rituxan, that the responses also looked quite good. And there was a very large trial from Germany that suggested that, in fact, lifetime maintenance with Rituxan after initial Rituxan CHOP chemotherapy really improved the outcomes fairly dramatically. So people began asking the question, and the legitimate question is it better to do maintenance therapy without transplant? Is it better to do transplant without maintenance? Or is it better to do transplant followed by maintenance? And indeed, there are some data now that suggest that people who have a transplant and then are randomized, this is in a clinical trial, to either no maintenance with Rituxan or maintenance with Rituxan, do better if they have maintenance. The other important sort of milestone was the development of new drugs, new agents to treat this disease. So the drug bendamustine, which is used in a variety of low-grade lymphomas, combined with Rituxan, has very good activity in mantle cell lymphoma, and people also are getting very durable remissions with that. The drug bortezomib, the drug lenalidomide, and in Europe, the drug temsirolimus have benefit and have good response rates in mantle cell lymphoma. Probably one of the most important advances, and you'll hear more about this, I think, when Dr. Haberman talks to you, is the development of the oral drug ibrutinib, which has been approved in the last only in the last couple of years for chronic lymphocytic leukemia and mantle cell lymphoma, and really has changed the game in mantle cell, especially in people who have recurrent disease. But now there are beginning to be some trials looking at ibrutinib as a first-line treatment or perhaps as a maintenance treatment. I alluded to the fact that this isn't one disease and that we can begin thinking of this as maybe a number of different diseases. There are patients, in fact, that we're beginning to see who may not need treatment at all initially. They may be observed just like we observe follicular lymphoma. That's one group, and there's a group of patients who may need the kind of treatment I've been talking about, and there's a third group of patients who have maybe perhaps very aggressive disease who may need novel forms of treatment that may include transplant and may include some other types of treatment. And this is based on a better understanding of the biology of the disease and the recognition of a variety of biologic factors which influence the outcome. The other important recognition is that after treatment, we think people are in remission perhaps, but there are now better ways to look at remission where we look at what we call minimal residual disease using very sophisticated molecular techniques. And those techniques may help us make determinations about which patients might need to go to transplant, which patients might be better off with maintenance treatment, and which patients might be better off with novel therapies. And so one of the ways to tell about the thinking of the disease in the oncology community is to look at the newest clinical trials. And there is a trial that's just being opened in the European Mantle Cell Network that compares chemotherapy plus transplant with chemotherapy plus ibrutinib as part of the initial treatment plus transplant, followed by 2 years of maintenance ibrutinib, and a third arm, which asks a very important question, and that is chemotherapy plus ibrutinib without a transplant, followed by 2 years of maintenance ibrutinib. And those are questions that are just beginning to be addressed. And I think as we understand the biology of the disease better and we understand how to measure minimal residual disease by molecular techniques, we can begin to personalize the treatment for this disease in a much better way. So I would say that from the beginning of our understanding to our current understanding, there have been huge leaps in the treatment and a much better outcome for this disease than we might have imagined back in 1994. So I'll stop at this point and maybe let Dr. Haberman talk about what to do with recurrent disease. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Gordon. That was very informative, very comprehensive, and I know the questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Thomas Haberman. Dr. Haberman is Professor of Medicine, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. And Dr. Haberman is going to address treatment options for relapsed refractory disease and emerging treatment approaches. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Haberman.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's an honor to be here with you and Caroline and all of our participants, and especially Drs. Gordon and Gopal, whom I have tremendous respect for. I think the first message that I would really like the participants to really understand is that there are tremendous options. There are tremendous options from the for initial treatment, as outlined by Dr. Gordon, but then if there is relapse, then there are a tremendous number of options. And we now have patients living beyond 15 years, some of whom have been on four or five different treatments. And so I think it's very important to understand that. Within the last very recent years, there were four drugs that have been licensed for use in mantle cell lymphoma in the United States: temsirolimus, bortezomib, lenalidomide, and ibrutinib. And these drugs have some different outcomes associated with them. the lenalidomide, bortezomib, and temsirolimus, about a third of patients respond to. And ibrutinib, those responses are significantly higher and for a significantly longer duration of time. The first 3 or 4 to 6 months in ibrutinib, the response rates are in at least the 14-month rates ranges, and on follow-up data, it is much longer. If one looks at different guidelines, and we know that patients look at different guidelines, as do physicians, the NCCN second-line therapies include therapies that Dr. Gordon alluded to, bendamustine rituximab, bortezomib with or without rituximab, cladribine with or without rituximab, ibrutinib alone or in combination, lenalidomide with alone or in combination, and then autologous and allogeneic stem cell transplant. And how we approach relapse is dependent upon what one received initially, but also most importantly, it's an age-dependent question. So if one looks at the an international practice guideline, the ESMO guidelines, for younger patients who relapse in less than 12 to 24 months, then immunochemotherapy, which would be a regimen such as bendamustine rituximab or rituximab with DHAP followed by an allotransplant, radioimmunotherapy and rituximab maintenance is their suggestion. In early relapses or in refractory cases, they suggest newer targeted approaches to be strongly considered. And as Dr. Gordon just outlined, rituximab maintenance can prolong both the progression-free and the overall survival. Bendamustine rituximab in relapse patients has a high response rate in the 76% range, and it can be for a very significant period of time. And this is a regimen that we're also studying up front, as Dr. Gordon mentioned, so we wouldn't use it up in relapse if it has already been used up front. When looking at the ibrutinib data, this changed the landscape significantly because the overall response rates were in the 67% rate, and patients could achieve a complete remission about a quarter of patients, and you could stay even in a partial remission for a very significant period of time. What's really mind-boggling in some ways, maybe at least to myself and some other colleagues, is that these are now oral agents that we're talking about. So lenalidomide, ibrutinib are oral agents. There are also other oral agents, and this is to stress the idea that you could be offered opportunities to participate in clinical trials, and as such, it's very difficult to lay these out within 10 minutes, but examples of which we were involved in the early lenalidomide trials, we've published on everolimus, a drug that's used more in breast cancer, and a third of the patients with mantle cell had very significant responses. And this is really the only way that we can find these new drugs, and I'm reasonably confident that we're going to find other drugs and other approaches, even though mantle cell has really benefited from some of the new drug discovery programs. There are a tremendous number of trials in lenalidomide. There are at least 8 or 9 trials internationally with bortezomib, bendamustine, dexamethasone, rituximab, combination of rituximab, lenalidomide, bendamustine, using lenalidomide maintenance after autostem cell transplant, and so forth. And I think this just points out the spectrum of these drugs and that we don't quite know what the most optimal ways to use them are in 2016, but that we're continually learning. And what we have continually learned in the last 5 to 10 years, I think, is mind-boggling. The whole question of quality of life comes into play in any kind of patients who are presented with lymphoproliferative disorders, or for that matter, any malignancies. And there have been some studies looking at the issue, and again, the single most important issue around quality of life is probably age, and the median age of the disease in the SEER program is 68, and looking at comprehensive geriatric assessment programs, looking at the ability to walk a block, falls, and so forth, can really help predict who might not do as well. And these would describe and be consistent with frailty, and if such, then we would be looking at, for instance, single-agent rituximab approaches or some other oral and less toxic regimens. We know that transplant-related mortalities come into play between less than 60, greater than 60, and greater than 70, and that these are quite different. We also know, and Dr. Gopal will probably comment on this later, that there is a very significant role for auto stem cell transplant in patients who relapsed, who weren't transplanted up front. The outcomes can be very significant, and the utilization of radioimmunotherapy can also significantly improve these outcomes. So when we look at the entire spectrum, I think there's never been a more exciting time in the field. There's never been a more exciting time in managing patients with mantle cell lymphoma, but there's probably never been a more complex time. And so how you will be approached will be dependent upon which institution or which cooperative group affiliations you see at the institutions that you're involved in, and there really aren't as many right and wrong answers as some of us would like to think. But the most important thing is that the prognosis has improved so significantly since the CHOP era, and so significantly even from the initial auto stem cell transplant era. The outcomes can be remarkable, and hopefully physicians and patients don't become discouraged if there is relapse, because there are so many things that we can do. So with that, I will turn my time back to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Haberman. That was really very, very informative and very a lot of information that would be helpful in coping with relapsed refractory disease, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Ajay Gopal. Dr. Gopal is Professor, Medical Oncology Division, University of Washington School of Medicine, Member, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Director of Clinical Research, Hematology, Malignancies, Hematology, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Gopal is going to address clinical trial updates, how research contributes to your treatment options, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Gopal.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure to speak here, and I also want to echo my appreciation to be able to speak in the same session with such experts as Dr. Gordon and Dr. Haberman. So it's a pleasure for me to be able to talk about clinical trials as they relate to mantle cell lymphoma, and I think as you've already heard during this session, it's a unique time that we live in terms of treatment options for patients with mantle cell lymphoma, and we wouldn't have been able to achieve any of these new therapies without the generous participation of patients with mantle cell lymphoma in clinical trials. I thought I first may start with just a quick overview talking about the different types of clinical trials so we're all on the same page regarding what these mean. We often hear terms thrown out about phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 clinical trials. And for the listeners, just to clarify, phase 1 trials typically are those studies where we are trying to sort out the optimal dose or dosing schema and get the first hint of the side effects and potentially how well a drug works in individuals. So these are often the first studies, typically based on laboratory data, when we evaluate a new therapy in patients with mantle cell lymphoma, for example. It does offer the first opportunity to get treated with a new therapy, but as by the nature of these studies, there is often less follow-up and long-term data with these drugs. I want to also just emphasize, however, that these phase one studies, albeit oftentimes the first time such a therapy is evaluated in humans, they do go through very, very rigorous review by the FDA, lots of safety data before they get into the clinic, and really they are very, very highly scrutinized, probably the most heavily scrutinized clinical trials that we carry out. Once we sort out what the optimal dose or dosing schema is, and ideally we get a hint of that these drugs may have efficacy, may work, we then often do phase two trials. And typically phase two trials are studies where we treat a number of individuals with the same therapy uniformly. And this is really to get a much better idea, a much more precise answer about how well these therapies work and what the side effects may be. And these types of trials are particularly important in mantle cell lymphoma. As you've heard, mantle cell lymphoma is a relatively rare disease, and it's a challenge to do large comparative trials in a rare disease. So oftentimes, and all the drugs that you actually heard about were really approved based on primarily phase two trials. So these were studies where folks were just treated uniformly with the same therapy. Now, if we really want to show that A is better than B or B is better than A, we have to do something called a phase three trial. And this is a study where we compare one therapy with another. And in the setting of mantle cell lymphoma, this often occurs after a new therapy is approved to really try to find out where does that therapy best fit in terms of treatment options. Is it better to use, for example, ibrutinib earlier? And you heard about trials. There's a trial called the Triangle Trial in Europe, and there was a trial in the U.S. called SHINE. Looked at the use of ibrutinib earlier in the course of the disease, or is it better to wait and use the ibrutinib later? So this is how we really get definitive answers about which approach might be best in a head-to-head coin flip kind of approach. It's important to also emphasize that in oncology, there really are not trials where someone only gets a placebo. Usually these are phase three trials, compare a standard approved, tried and true approach with something that may add additional therapy or add something else to it. So these are not studies typically where someone does not receive an active therapy. So the next question often comes up, and as was mentioned by Dr. Haberman, is it's a very complicated visit. When I think back, when I would sit down with individuals with mantle cell lymphoma a decade ago, it was actually quite a short discussion because the list was relatively short about what options we had. Now we have many options in our hands, and I really talk to patients about the long game. This is a game where we want to strategize to get the best outcome, and which includes the best quality of life. And I will admit my bias, and I think likely the bias of those on the call here, is that clinical trials do play a key role in achieving that long game. If we think of this as a situation, a disease where we treat with one therapy that works for a period of time, and then we treat with another therapy that works for a period of time, the more options we have, the better chance we have to reach that long-term goal of trying to have outcomes be the same as if someone didn't have mantle cell lymphoma, which is ultimately our goal. So when I sit down with patients, I talk about clinical trials. We have many choices off the shelf, but the off-the-shelf options aren't going away. Clinical trial options, sometimes there's a window of opportunity. If we think about the individuals who had the opportunity to be the first participants in the ibrutinib trial, they achieved benefit from participating in that trial. And then the therapy was no longer available until it got FDA approved for use. So I often talk to my patients about increasing the number of choices on the menu by participating in clinical trials. And this is really where it's important to sit down with somebody who specializes in lymphoma, typically at a large center, a large academic center, and can talk about which options are maybe appropriate for an individual. So clinical trials can play a major role in achieving the long game. So what are some of the options that are being studied now? And the list is very long, and this will be a very abbreviated list. But as we understand much more about the biology of lymphomas, and specifically mantle cell lymphoma, you've heard about the drug ibrutinib. But now there are therapies that are second and third generation of these drugs that may be more efficacious and may have less side effects, and those are being evaluated. There are other parts of the signaling pathway inside these cancerous B cells that are being targeted, drugs that target something called PI3 kinase. There are other drugs that target something called BCL2. And then there are other completely different strategies. We heard about transplantation, which basically puts a new immune system in one's body with a donor. So if we talk about allogeneic transplantation, and there's also autologous transplant, which can be different ways to do that, which may improve outcomes. And finally, I'll mention another therapy, which is, I think, really in its infancy regarding mantle cell lymphoma, but we're certainly all hopeful. It's a way of engineering one's T cells by putting in a gene that tells the T cells to go and attack the lymphoma cells, and this is commonly known as CAR T cells. One may have seen that in the popular press. And we're hopeful that this may be another approach for those individuals who have a very tough to treat mantle cell lymphoma and are otherwise relatively healthy. This may be another strategy. So in summary, clinical trials offer more options. They are a key part of the strategy when I sit down with patients in my clinic about how do we put together the best approach for the long game to maximize the quality of life and also try to approach as close as we can to what one's normal survival would be without mantle cell lymphoma. So with that, I think we're right around the end of my time, and I will turn it back over to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Gopal. That was excellent and just really very important to call out in terms of clinical trials and how important they are. I know that there are questions about clinical trials during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Caroline Edlund. Ms. Edlund is an oncology social worker, and she is Cancer Care's online support group program director. And Ms. Edlund is going to be addressing the free psychosocial support services and programs at Cancer Care and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my colleague, Ms. Edlund.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. And I would like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to speak with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and your family. A cancer care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer care services are there to help. So please contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you so much, Caroline. That was excellent. And now we have time for questions. I want to thank all of our speakers for making that possible. So we now have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Candace to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. And Candace, would you all bring all of our speakers on board, all their lines open, so that we can all address the questions as they come in, okay?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one.
We have a question from one of our online participants, Michael. And Michael's question is, my doctor recently prescribed ibrutinib for me. What has been the experience of patients using this drug? Dr. Haberman, could you address that question?
I think the initial data that has come out and that was published in the New England Journal and other follow-up data would suggest that about two-thirds of patients respond. By 2014, the 67% of patients had responded. It's important to understand that the complete remission rate was about 22% in that study, the median progression-free survival, that is the time that it takes for patients to be on the drug before they have relapsed, was 13 months. That was just at that time. I think some of that's now likely longer, but they're ongoing. The data, these patients are being followed and so forth. So I think the important thing is that these were in relapsed refractory patients. And what we don't understand is would patients do better if they were treated up front? Those studies are ongoing, but these were the highest response rates ever reported. In the very initial data with lenalidomide, it was 53% in a very small study that we did, but then when the study got bigger, it dropped down to about 28 to 30% of patients. So this is an extremely important drug in mantle cell lymphoma.
Excellent. Thank you. And does anyone want to add anything? Any other thoughts?
Okay. I think just to stress what a couple things that Tom alluded to. One is in terms of the toxicity, generally pretty well tolerated. There is a maybe 5 to 10% incidence of atrial fibrillation which occurs with this drug, but that usually can be managed reasonably well. There's mild diarrhea in the beginning, but most people are taking this like they may be taking blood pressure medications and things of that sort, perhaps. At least that's been the analogy, and hopefully those responses will last. The other thing is to say that there are some trials beginning to look at ibrutinib as part of the upfront treatment. We're looking at it as a maintenance after initial chemotherapy. The people at MD Anderson are looking at first, followed by aggressive chemotherapy. And then I mentioned the triangle trial where it's being looked at as part of initial therapy, too. So trying to incorporate that drug into upfront treatment is sort of the next question that's being addressed.
I guess the only other thing I'd add for everyone in the audience, because it's likely over time most patients with mantle cell will be on this drug, there are very significant drug interactions with other drugs with ibrutinib, and it is extremely important that someone review this carefully. And we are now to the point that we have our pharmacists review the drug profiles that patients are on before patients go on ibrutinib, because the list of these drug interactions are not short.
That's one thing for people to think about, and then the whole issue of drug interactions in general. That's an excellent point. Thank you. And thanks, Michael. I hope this helps you, and you'll take this information back to your treating healthcare team, and it'll be useful to you in your care. And we have another question from one of our online participants, from Patty. My husband was diagnosed with stage 4 mantle cell lymphoma in November 2013. And it's a little bit of a long question. He did chemotherapy, R-CHOP, cytarabine, Zevalin, and an autologous bone marrow transplant. His scans since then have been clear, but he had endoscopy and colonoscopy done in December, and there were mantle cells discovered in his rectum. His oncologist is recommending a watch-and-wait approach for now. Is this the right approach for mantle cell lymphoma, or is it more beneficial to begin treatment right away? So this is an excellent question, Patty. Now, I'm going to ask our speakers to address your question in a general way, because they obviously don't have all the information they would need to give you an answer, whether you should do one or the other. But perhaps they could help you with some of the questions that you might want to ask in terms of making that decision or in working with your healthcare team. Does that make sense, Dr. Gordon, to start with that, just to kind of give some general thoughts on this issue to think
sure.
about?
Sure. Okay. I think one of the questions that has come up really is, when we do transplant, is there a complete remission as judged by our scans, CAT scans, PET scans, maybe endoscopy, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier, do we have minimal residual disease by molecular markers? So, and I think what's being described here is a little bit more than minimal residual disease. It's disease in the GI tract that's present. But it's certainly, I think, an approach that we've also taken in some instances where the disease may recur, but it's recurring in a very indolent fashion. We know, I said earlier, that there is maybe about anywhere from 10 to 25% of patients that are first diagnosed, and we just make a decision to observe them, not necessarily do treatment. So, and that tells us that there's an indolent version of mantle cell lymphoma. So it's possible that this recurrence in the GI tract, I don't know if this was the first endoscopy that was done or it was done just at the end of treatment, but it's quite possible that this could be a very indolent course from now on, that the bulk of the disease was taken care of by the prior treatment, and now it's quite possible to just observe this patient. That's something we've done, but also patients such as this might be candidates for clinical trials. Maybe Ajay can address this. If there's disease that can be measured, maybe it'd be an opportunity to look at some of the more novel agents. But certainly as a treatment strategy, that sounds appropriate for many patients.
Excellent. And Dr. Gopal, did you want to?
Yes, I mean, I would concur completely that this is a strategy that we often employ, particularly if there's been a fair amount of time between the last therapy and we it appears that the trajectory of the growth of the mantle cell lymphoma is fairly flat. Things aren't changing very quickly. Certainly, observation is a very reasonable strategy, even in the recurrent or relapse setting. But as Dr. Gordon mentioned, it does open the window of opportunity to participate in a clinical trial, particularly with a very novel therapy, because there's no urgent need for attaining a remission. And I think that's really the optimal setting for trying something new, is when there's not an urgent need that there's going to be some problem if we don't get a remission very quickly. That's the time when one has the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial and really add another option to the menu. I think one point that Dr. Gordon also made was that most clinical trials do require something called measurable disease. So there needs to be something that we can either feel on a physical exam or see on a scan to see if it gets smaller to know whether the therapy is working. So it sounds like that may not be the case currently, which is great, but it does raise a possibility that if that does occur in a very indolent fashion, that it may be the right time to talk about a clinical trial.
Okay, and I think we have some Candace, some questions on the phone as well.
Yes, our first question comes from the line of Marilyn H. Your line is now open.
I apparently have the indolent form. The cancer was not detected in 2002, but the lymphocyte level was above, out of the normal range. And there were some misdiagnoses. But anyway, it's a long time that, and I have not needed treatment. You mentioned sophisticated techniques to classify the type of mantle cell. Is this something that would be beneficial to me to have? And I also heard somewhere about a FISH test that is specific to mantle cell, not just the initial FISH test, which wasn't done on me. I demanded it, and that's how we discovered that I had mantle cell, right. 2008.
So,
excellent question.
So I can maybe begin to address. So it sounds like this is, in fact, from the description, one of the indolent versions of mantle cell lymphoma, typically presenting with maybe a slightly elevated white count. And I'm sure when you said misdiagnosis, people thought it might be CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which is the initial thought. And what we've learned is that this type, very often people don't need to be treated for years and years. You said, I think, 2002. So that's not that unusual, and it might never need to be treated, really. And in terms of the molecular markers I was talking about, this is the type that probably doesn't have a gene called SOX11. SOX11 is a gene that's been looked at in mantle cell lymphoma for a number of years, and we now have a good way to measure it. We didn't have it before. So I don't think it's necessarily to do that, because I think the clinical picture tells the story better even than that test might. But for some patients, that test might be helpful. But in your case, I'm not sure that it would necessarily add anything. Sounds like you're going to do very well. The FISH test, I think you probably are talking about the 1114 translocation, which is the way the diagnosis is made. I alluded to this earlier, that there's an exchange of material from chromosome number 11 to chromosome number 14, and that's how we know it's mantle cell lymphoma. Otherwise, it probably looks just like chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So, I think the course that you've had is typical for that very indolent variety, and it'll continue to do well.
Excellent. Well, thank you. And Mel, I hope that's helpful to you, and you'll take that back to your treating healthcare team. And thank you. Okay, our next question.
And our next question comes from Ann F. Your line is now open.
Thank you, doctors. I had a question. Actually, it was a two-part question. Part one is, I know that there's a subset of patients who do very poorly on ibrutinib with a poor clinical outcome and poor survival. Is there genomic testing that can isolate that group? Also, the second part is there a particular subset where they found the CAR T-cell regimen in the early testing so far to be more effective, i.e. de novo disease or refractory?
Well, those are excellent questions. Dr. Haberman, do you want to address those?
I think that perhaps for Ajay to answer the second part of the, to answer first regarding the CAR T-cells, is their institution has had the most extensive experience of our three institutions?
I can comment only that, you know, this is really, we're just beginning to evaluate the efficacy of CAR T cells. Certainly remissions have been seen, but I think beyond that, it's hard to know how often that happens. So it's hard to say much more than that, other than we're certainly hopeful and we have seen that it can be effective, but how frequently it's effective, I think we don't know yet.
Right. And I think to add to that, I'm not sure. I think there's probably not information yet that tells us which patients are more likely to benefit from CAR T, just because those trials have just begun. And the other part, I'm not aware that there are genomic data that suggest that people will specifically not respond well to ibrutinib. There are data that suggest that people may not do well in general. It's a little bit more aggressive course, and that's people that have something called notch mutations and people that have P53 expression or a lot of SOX11. In general, I think those results aren't as good, but whether it's specific to ibrutinib, I'm not sure there are enough data to tell us that. I think we're just beginning to learn how to figure out why people either respond initially and then stop responding to ibrutinib, or whether they don't respond at all. That's just beginning to be done now.
And the other group, it appears that the responses aren't as good, and there's not as much published data on this probably, but are the blastoid variants.
Mm-hmm.
But the in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, they're further ahead because of the 17p deletion patients and some other issues in defining who's not going to do well with ibrutinib. But I agree with Leo. I don't think we know that at this point in time in mantle cell lymphoma.
I would agree as well. In CLL, there are data to say that there are some clones of CLL that where the ibrutinib binds doesn't bind as well, and that there may be other mutations that either were there at the beginning or occurred over time. But I don't think we quite know that yet in mantle cell lymphoma.
It's a wonderful question, Anne. Really, a very cutting-edge question, and it's. I guess we don't have all the answers here, but I hope that you'll, again, continue to ask your healthcare team about that and be aware of new information that will come out on this. Thank you. And our next question?
And our next question comes from Pat G. Your line is now open.
Hi, yes. I was diagnosed about 8.5 years ago. Went through a very, very aggressive mantle cell is what I was told, with a poor prognosis. I went through both parts of a hyper-CVAD thing, but had to go on to CHOP because the other was just taking too much of a toll, and then went on Rituxan maintenance. And then less than a year after I stopped the maintenance, it came back, so we did bendamustine and started a Rituxan maintenance, but relapsed while taking it. So then I went on to ibrutinib, which everyone was very excited about, and I had a severe allergic reaction, all the way to my tongue swelling, and after about 2.5 weeks. And so they had me stop it for 6 weeks and try just one pill, and I had the same reaction.
And your question, Pat?
Yes. Oh, my question is, and it seems to have morphed into a more indolent type now. And so for 2 years, I haven't had treatment, but we've talked about what to do. So I guess one option is to try to desensitize to ibrutinib, and I'm wondering if there's any information on that. Has that been a possibility?
That's an excellent question. Thank you, Pat. And Dr. Gordon, do you want to try that? The first.
Well, I think that we've not seen that. But of interest, actually, ibrutinib is being tested. Our allergy group is testing ibrutinib as a way to prevent allergic reactions to things like bee stings and other things. So it's actually an anti-allergen, if you will. It looks like there are data that suggest that it's going to block allergic reactions. But I think there probably is a way. We've not had to do it, but I'm guessing there may be a way to sensitize. We've not had to do it, but I think it's something that could be looked into. The allergy people are able to desensitize to lots of different medications, so it's not out of the question. I don't know if anyone has experience having to do that, but we don't so far.
We don't have experience either, but this question just came up in a patient was involved in just last week about with regard to rituximab. And with most drugs, there are some ways to develop a desensitization program. On the other hand, there are also other treatments that are available, which I think would also be an option for patients who are in these types of situations.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank our speakers. You've been extraordinary. And I also want to thank all of the participants on this call. You've really asked extraordinary questions, both online and on the telephone. I think that our participants actually are quite informed and really asking very informed questions. So I want to really say that to all of you. I want to remind everyone this is a one-hour workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we do recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so because we know that there are more questions that you have and that you may have more questions at the end of the call, I want to give you some information that I hope will help you in terms of just getting any questions that you may continue to have. And there are some questions that we weren't able to get to in the time that we have. So for anyone who has a medically focused question, I often recommend that you do call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. And the other organization that we always recommend is, of course, the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And they also have a number that you can call as well, which is 1-800-500-9976. Again, 1-800-500-9976. And if you have questions in terms of just your coping with mantle cell lymphoma or your interest in joining a support group or just talking with someone for some counseling services or practical and financial assistance, I would say go ahead and call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673 to speak with one of our oncology social workers here who can help you with many of your concerns and questions. Most importantly, as we conclude today's program, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with mantle cell lymphoma or cancer in general. I want you to know that you're now part of this community here, lots of organizations in addition to Cancer Care that can help you. And I don't want anyone to feel you're alone. I think that Caroline Edelman had said that earlier as well. We want you to now know that you have resources and that you simply can call us, even if you're not even sure what your question is, that you just need to talk to somebody. So I want to kind of encourage you all to do that. And I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for your participation. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.